From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in downtown San Francisco.
I'm in the Mission.
Oakland, 33rd and Telegraph.
Off Piedmont Avenue.
Coming up, local Muslim women feel the spike in Islamophobia.
I was just really taken aback that this could happen in San Francisco, in an area where you think people are more accepting because it's so diverse.
Then bending boundaries with contortionist Phoenix Paz.
It's the raw power of what the human body can do with the best of what society has to offer.
And we find out the answer to this week's Audiograph Mystery Sound.
I do declare you to be well and truly married.
We're getting hitched today on Cross Currents. In his State of the Union address Tuesday, President Obama addressed a prejudicial rift that's been dividing the United States.
When politicians insult Muslims, whether abroad or our fellow citizens, when a mosque is vandalized or a kid is called names, that doesn't make us safer. That's not telling it like it is. It's just wrong. It diminishes us in the eyes of the world. It makes it harder to achieve our goals. It betrays who we are as a country.
Anti-Muslim sentiment around the U.S. is on the rise. The uptick started right after the attacks in Paris in November. Then came the December shootings in San Bernardino and Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump's call for a ban on Muslim entry into the country. Now, American Muslims are at risk all over the country. According to CARE, a Muslim civil rights group, there were 75 attacks on mosques reported in the U.S. last year. That's the highest on record. Here in the Bay Area, in the last month alone, a Castro Valley woman verbally attacked and threw coffee on Muslim picnickers at Lake Chabot. Police arrested a man who threatened a Richmond mosque with a pipe bomb. And on the day after Christmas, a mosque was firebombed in Tracy. To find out more about the surge in Islamophobia and how it's affecting Bay Area Muslims, I headed to Santa Clara to meet up with Zahra Billu. She's the executive director of the Bay Area chapter of CARE, the Council on American-Islamic Relations. They're a Muslim civil rights group that fields calls from people who've been harassed because of their faith and then provides legal aid. It's Friday morning, and I find Billu working in a coffee shop, not her office. I'll let her tell you why.
We're in a coffee shop working remotely because our offices were evacuated following a suspicious package, and we are cooperating with law enforcement, giving them all the space they need to thoroughly investigate.
The package contained a white powder. Police, FBI, firefighters, and a hazardous materials team shut down the CARE office to investigate. Three CARE workers were sent to the hospital for medical investigation and released later that night. A week earlier, CARE's Washington, D.C. headquarters also received a suspicious package. The powder sent to CARE turned out to be benign in both cases, but Billu says it's been a difficult time recently for Muslims.
We've seen an unprecedented number of complaints to the CARE offices across the country. Everything from people being yelled at in parking lots or being bullied at school to violent attacks on people like the one at Lake Chabot.
There are about 250,000 Muslims living in the Bay Area, mostly in the South Bay, where the CARE offices are, and in the East Bay. In San Francisco, the Tenderloin neighborhood has a sizable Arab Muslim population, which is why when Asya Abdurrahman was recently verbally attacked there, she was surprised. She and her mom and two children were walking in the Tenderloin in the afternoon when she says a man walked by and shouted at them, "No more Muslims."
I was just really taken aback that this could happen in San Francisco, in an area where you think people are more accepting because it's so diverse.
Asya Abdurrahman and her mother both wear the Islamic headscarf, the hijab. But she says things are different now.
You know, there are a lot of people who wear headscarves in the Tenderloin. It isn't uncommon. So it's a normal thing, but now it's as if, you know, people are staring at you more accusatory, as if you've committed a crime.
Muslim women are especially at risk in times of increased Islamophobia because they're visually identifiable as Muslims because of the hijab.
Almost like we would talk of white privilege, I have this non-wearing hijab privilege.
That's Muaz Inam, a theology student at Zaytuna College in Berkeley. His wife wears a headscarf, and he says he sees Islamophobia mostly through her experiences on the street, not his. Once they witnessed a Sikh man in a turban trying to cross the street. A driver was blocking him and wouldn't move. Inam's wife told him that happens to her all the time.
So I feel like there's a lot of things that I take for granted as a man that's not necessarily recognized, right, as a Muslim.
Since the attacks in Paris, conversations about Muslim women and public safety have ramped up at mosques and Islamic centers and online. After the San Bernardino attacks, the popular website MuslimGirl.net issued a 7-page Muslim women safety guide. Among the tips, be aware of your surroundings, try not to travel alone at night, and if you feel at high risk, you may decide to temporarily take off your scarf for safety reasons.
I was like, oh my God, this is too much. Maybe I should just take it off.
San Francisco high school student Nora Abdelal wears a headscarf. The 17-year-old says she's getting longer stares and glares in public spaces, like the library.
And then I think, well, I thought this is a country where you could practice your religion for free, but I really feel like I can't practice my religion for free if every time I go outside, people are just going to, like, treat me differently, especially in neighborhoods like the Mission where a lot of new people are moving in, and I walk and people stare at me.
The new people.
The new people, yeah. And I'm just like, I was born here.
Other tips from the safety guide? Muslim women who don't want to totally take the hijab off can keep a baseball cap or a beanie handy to wear so as not to draw attention by, quote, looking Muslim. Asya Abdurrahman, the woman who was yelled at in the Tenderloin, takes issue with that.
I'm not going to change who I am and how I am. That's allowing whoever is trying to intimidate me to control me. And I'm not going to take it off because I'm afraid. Actually, you know, I'm kind of a stubborn person, so I'm going to wear it more.
And women who are not Muslim have worn scarves in solidarity and support of their Muslim counterparts. A professor at a Christian college in Illinois was put on leave last month after she donned a scarf at work. The university administration is holding a hearing later this month on her possible termination. Back in the Santa Clara coffee shop, CARE executive director Zahra Bilu works at her laptop, snacking on a batch of cookies she made this morning. She says she's not discouraged. Her message to Muslim women is to try not to be out alone, but also
to be aware of the fact that I think a lot of people are expressing support of Muslims and Muslim women these days. Be cautious and optimistic.
Bilu and the CARE team were cleared to move back into their offices in Santa Clara 3 days after the FBI shut them down. They went right back to work, following up on other anti-Muslim incidents, like a Molotov cocktail that exploded outside a Tracy mosque on December 26th. The FBI is offering $2,500 to anyone who has information benefiting the investigation. CARE has also issued a Muslim parents' guide to talking to your kids about violent extremism. Check it out at kalw.org. Click Cross Currents. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. Education can take many forms, literally. Phoenix Paz is a teacher of contortion. She's a teacher at the San Francisco Circus Center and says she made her home in circus arts because she wanted to push her body to its limits. Phoenix Paz told KALW's Jen Sheehan about how the key to twisting your body is to stretch your imagination.
When did you start doing circus performing or circus arts?
I started training actually in 2014 in March.
I graduated from Oxford and was like, what do I really want to do with my life? And I decided I really wanted to do the circus.
You graduated from Oxford. What were you studying there? Not circus.
Nah. I studied the idea of national identity formation and the way immigration plays into that.
Did you know, you know, when you were a kid, were you interested, or was it something that was buried deep within and then it came out after all of your academic studies?
It's definitely something that I've always been interested in, but my interest has grown and developed as I continue to become more academic. And when I graduated from university, I decided that this is a really important part of what I want to do and what I'm interested in, that I didn't get the opportunity to study at all. And so I decided to take the time to make sure that I created space for circus in my life.
And what is it about it? What is it about circus that draws you?
I think it's the idea of always pushing your limits, of exceeding yourself, of doing the impossible. And the human body is capable of so much. And nowhere is it more clear than when you're doing circus that you are really pushing the boundaries of what people are capable of physically, artistically.
Well, you do contortion.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit more about that? What does that entail?
Contortion is extreme flexibility training. So what it is it's learning not only how to increase your range of motion, but it's training the strength and the control so that you can utilize that range of motion, that flexibility. Without hurting yourself. And you can do a variety of different moves and poses and transitions between them.
And do you have to be naturally already really flexible to do it?
Flexibility is like any other skill. It's a learned skill and trained technique as much as it is a natural talent for it. Generally, in contortion, it's a very distinct feeling, like that extreme stretching and that way of pushing your body.
You said it's a distinct feeling. What does it feel like?
It's like finding a wall and pushing past that wall. It's pushing yourself past the limits that you think you can hit.
What are some of your favorite moves or maybe your favorite challenges that you have overcome?
I love chin stands.
What's a chin stand?
So chin stand is where the performer has their chin and their chest flat against the floor, and they take their feet and put it up behind their heads. So you bring your butt to your head and you put your feet in front of you.
Uh-huh. And it's extreme back bend.
Yeah.
I think I've seen that. Uh-huh.
And I like it. I think it's super cute.
Is that like the pose you'd use for your holiday greeting cards?
Yeah, exactly. Where you're just here with your head between your knees.
Uh-huh. Your feet just right there by your ears.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Like you're wearing them like earrings. Yeah.
And how long did it take you to be able to get there to do that pose?
It probably took about a year.
I'm speaking with San Francisco circus artist and teacher Phoenix Paz. Well, let's talk more about circus as an art form. Like these days, pretty much everyone has at least heard of Cirque du Soleil or seen little clips of it, if not the actual live shows. And that's a different style from the Barnum and Bailey type stuff that I saw when I was a kid. Tell me about the range of stuff that fits under the circus umbrella, or the circus big top, if you will, these days.
Definitely. So traditionally, there's the European style circus, which has always been a one ring circus tent. And it's a smaller group. A smaller troupe that does that sort of thing. And then the American circus has traditionally been the three-ring circus, and you had the big top events, and then you'd have the two little tops, and one of the smaller tops would generally be like a variety show with dancers and magicians and all of the things like
vaudeville.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And then the other one would be kind of like a freak show, and that's always been a fundamental part of the American circus tours and the way it started. But the interesting thing about that was it was the way people got exposed to performers from around the world, like contortionists or like African stilt walkers or dancers. And so the freak shows weren't always just about freaks. It was about something that was out of the ordinary, something extraordinary, and showing that. And then today, we're in a phase called New Circus or Contemporary Circus.
going back to the rawness of the human body, there's a lot less of the fancy costuming, a lot less of the bright colors. There's no animals involved in Cirque Nouveau traditions or in contemporary circus, and there's a lot more of incorporation of storytelling elements and aspects of it, which is what people are really excited about right now, is using circus and using the human body to tell stories.
You talked about being drawn to circus as a personal experience of pushing your own boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
What about from the outside, before you started doing it, what was inspiring to you about watching?
The inspiration about watching circus was this idea of weightlessness and, again, the idea of achieving the impossible. I would go and see the circus and watch these people do things, and they were flying across the floor doing all of these amazing tumbles and jumps and power tumbling. You can jump like 10 feet in the air and do multiple backspins and land on your feet and be like safe and light and content doing it.
Sort of like real life superheroes.
Exactly. So it was kind of like that, or like parkour. You see all of the kung fu movies and circus is really what it's all about. And just the control and the beauty and the precision and the mastery of speed. So amazing, and all of it together with the music and the costumes and the aesthetics, that's really what appealed to me, was the combination of the two, is it's the raw power of what the human body can do with the best of what society has to offer.
That was contortionist Phoenix Paz speaking with KALW's Jen Sheehan. Paz and the Circus Center artists perform their new cabaret, Champagne and Starlight, tomorrow and Saturday in San Francisco. More information is at KALW.org. Click Cross Currents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. And now it's time for Audiograph, the Bay Area's sonic signature. All week long, we've been playing you this sound.
You feel like you're in 10 different weddings.
I do declare you to be well and truly married, spouses for life. Congratulations, and please seal it with a kiss.
Think you know what that is and where we recorded it? Well, KALW's Hannah Kingsley-Ma brings us the story.
If you're having a major life event in San Francisco, it's likely that the office of the county clerk in City Hall is involved. It issues birth and death certificates, it registers businesses, and...
What are you guys doing here today?
We're getting married.
We're getting married.
My name is Emily Barnett, for now.
And my name is Carlos Moreno. Hopefully not for now. We'll find out what we're doing in the future.
Moreno and Barnett are one of the many festooned couples waiting in the hallway outside the office of the county clerk. They're about to get married in the rotunda in San Francisco City Hall. Typically, three couples are married every half an hour. These two, they're eloping, and they traveled all the way from Tennessee to do it.
We didn't necessarily want all of our friends at the wedding. No, I'm kidding.
No, he's not.
This is going out to the world, baby.
I approach another couple, Tet Joe and Hilly Luo, who tell me about how they made their decision to get married here.
They were saying that it's the most famous place to get married, and that's why we chose this place.
Why is it the most famous place to be married?
That I have no idea. I Googled. I didn't Google why.
You don't have to Google why. You just have to step inside to understand. The rotunda has limestone walls and is covered in ornate relief sculptures, including a portrait of Father Time. It sits on top of a grand staircase that cascades below onto a pink marble floor. It's an architectural masterpiece, glamorous enough to make Marilyn Monroe and Joe DiMaggio choose it as their wedding destination back in 1954. But before you get there, you have to wait here. In a hallway lined with benches, a TV screen simultaneously broadcasting the latest Board of Supervisors meeting and the numbers showing who's up next.
Now entering day four.
What's it like standing in this room full of all these other people getting married?
Relieving, I guess. Like, you're not the only one, I guess. Feel like you're part of a crowd. It's just like going to a football game.
Yeah, and we congratulations to each other. Yeah, it's pretty fun.
Waiting gives you time to observe the variation each couple brings to their ceremony. I see poofy wedding gowns, fitted vintage dresses, tuxedos, running shorts, a plaid kilt. And I'm in the uncomfortable position of asking the surrounding couples if I can crash their wedding. Luckily for me, Frank Lung and Verna Chin say yes. I sit with their families and friends as they wait for their number, B221, to be called.
Why are you here today?
I'm the auntie.
You're all the auntie.
Yeah, that's my niece. Oh, my name is Cherry. My last name is Chu. I live in Moraga.
And you got married too in the city hall?
Yeah. In Alabama. Opelika, Alabama. Years and years and years ago. Short and sassy. And cheap.
Short, sassy, and cheap. Aunt Cherry's recipe for a perfect wedding. And she has a point. In 2014, the average cost for a wedding in the U.S. was over $31,000. Here at City Hall, it's $105 for the marriage license, and $78 for the ceremony. The additional costs are minor in comparison, like feeding the parking meter. After some anxious pacing, Frank and Verna's number gets called. Two witnesses watch as they sign their marriage license, and then we all smush into a nearby elevator in search of the rotunda.
Are we here?
Do you see
one
a rotunda?
More.
Yeah,
this is it.
One more.
This is it?
That's it, yeah.
The doors open to a chaotic scene. City Hall is swarming with tourists snapping selfies, and the newly married posing for photos on the staircase. In the middle of the crowd, a figure in a billowing robe comes barreling towards us.
You're still here. Okay, we got everybody?
I believe so.
Wait, what are we looking for?
The bride's father.
Oh, that's important.
The woman officiating is Claudia Anderson. She's a deputy marriage commissioner, and she's having a really busy day.
Yeah, how many people have you married today?
1, 2, 3, 4, 6, 8 couples.
And how many will you marry at the end of the day?
I have 3 more to marry, and then I'm finished for the day.
Anderson's got a tough job. She's got to make this ceremony meaningful, but she's also got to make it snappy. In the day's hustle and bustle, the marriage queue has gotten backed up, and couples are waiting. Luckily, Anderson's a total pro.
So if you will turn and face each other and hold hands. And so Franklin, both hands if you can. So Franklin, I ask of you, are you in fact prepared today in the presence of family and friends who are gathered around you to accept Verna to be your lawfully wedded spouse?
The ceremony, vows, rings, smooch, takes just under 5 minutes.
I do declare you to be well and truly married, spouses for life. Congratulations, and please seal it with a kiss.
Yay! Anderson takes on her next task, moving the wedding party off the stairs.
Great, and I know you have to go find the next couple
now. Okay. Josh and C.
Before she was marrying 12 couples a day, Anderson worked for the school district. I spoke to another deputy marriage commissioner named Cynthia Gregory, who was an IT professional before donning the black robe.
People are so hopeful and joyful and in love at this time in their lives, and that just fills me up.
Cynthia Gregory and Claudia Anderson are part of a long-standing legacy of unpaid, volunteer deputy marriage commissioners. When same-sex marriage was first declared legal in California in 2008, the office of the county clerk trained around 350 volunteers to help administer the weddings. Cynthia Gregory wasn't around then, but she was on the day 7 years later, when same-sex marriage became legal across the country.
People were like dancing in the halls here.
After a year and a half on the job, Gregory has seen it all. A bride falling down the stairs, a ring bouncing its way across the marble floor, couples straight from Burning Man, dirt encrusted and urgent. But she has one memory that stands out to her in particular.
One time, I had an older couple, and I still remember what he said. He said, I cannot give you the springtime of life, but I can give you the fall with all of its colors. And that was years ago, and that line has stuck with me ever since.
In San Francisco, I'm Hannah Kingsley Ma.
This week's winner was Carrie Messina. Congratulations, Carrie. We're sending you a KALW t-shirt. And if you've got ideas for where we should record next, tell us about them at news@kalw.org. And because of you, we can proudly say we are listener-supported public radio. Our team includes Shireen Adil, Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Nina Gensler-Debs, Angela Johnston, Ian Lewis, Casey Miner, Ted Muldoon, James Rowlands, Raja Shah, and Stephen Short. Today's show is engineered by Chris Hoff. The line producer was Hannah Kingsley Ma. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.